ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the UI Breakfast Podcast. I'm your host, Jane Portman, and today our guest is Jeff Davidson, solo product designer and writer, and we're going to talk about the psychology of addictive products. This episode is brought to you by userlist.io. This new tool helps SaaS founders get a better understanding of each individual user journey and send users relevant behavior-based email. To learn more, join the waiting list at userlist.io. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Jane.
Thank you so much for making the time for us today.
Not a problem.
Before we get started, could you please tell us a little bit about your background, what you do, and how you got started?
Absolutely. So I consider myself a product designer. My background is actually industrial design, so building physical, tangible things. Sort of halfway through my education, I kind of realized that the world doesn't need a new toaster. And it seemed like a lot of the jobs and what people were looking for out there was merely a stylist. And I think that you and I both know that design is more than just making something look pretty. It's about making something that has value and is also functional. So now I've sort of went into the UX UI field probably roughly 8 years ago. Mm-hmm. So I've been doing it for about 10 years. I work primarily with startups. So doing consulting services as well. And I also write about design, primarily the intersection of science and design. I think what we see a lot in the UX industry is a lot of hearsay. So what I'd like to do is actually bring in rigorous science and then integrate it with design philosophy.
How did you come up with such amazing, you know, direction for your writing? Because we usually, like, we're so much practitioners that not all designers at all bring in science. But do you do any special reading? Do you have any special education? How do you source your material for this writing?
To be honest, I was always just very fascinated with human behavior. Mm-hmm. And I think that as designers, that should be somewhat in your wheelhouse, right? Because we're essentially designing things for humans, and we have to understand how humans work in order to design better for them. So if I were to give anyone a recommendation on readings, I would say just pick up like a psychology book and then read everything from the earliest 20th century and then beyond. And then you're going to get a good understanding of how humans work. So some of my heroes in psychology are, you know, the early guys from B.F. Skinner to Pavlov, and then moving forward to today, like Daniel Kahneman in his brilliant book, Thinking Fast and Slow. Mm-hmm. So we're going to get, if you do these readings, then I think you're generally going to become a better designer. There was no formal background. And also let me preface this by saying I am not a scientist, and I'm not a scientist. So if I have my references a little bit wrong, please forgive me.
I'm quite sure that's not a problem. It's amazing to see, what insights you have, extracted from your many years of reading all these psychological books.
Yeah.
So for addictive products, my question number one was actually the purpose of designing addictive products and the ethical part of it. And our pre-chat showed that you also had the same concern that designing addictive products shouldn't be a self-purpose, right?
No. The reason why I actually titled the article that was, one, because I could get conversion, because a lot of entrepreneurs are like, hey, I want to create something addictive, right? So it's like, okay. But really the crux of the article is talking about the seeking system And it's something, as I mentioned previously, has been somewhat overlooked in psychology. And it's something that I've been started studying over the past 2 years. And I think it's a very paramount theory to understand when you're designing. So the way that we used to think of human behavior in the early 20th century, it was very Freudian way of thinking about motivation, right? So generally, people thought that humans do things for a physiological purpose, right? So we want food and we want sex. So that's at the, sort of the lower end of the triangle. So are you familiar with Abraham's or Maslow's hierarchy of needs?
Oh, absolutely. The triangle?
Right. So essentially the way he laid it out is that humans basically sort of linearly go through this progression of let's say fulfillment in life, and first you get your food and water, then you get your shelter, etc., and then essentially self-actualization at the top. And Freud was very similar in the way, right? So he thought that the motivations for behavior was at the core was sex and aggression. But there was a discovery that happened in 1956, I believe that was the year. And it was by a scientist named Harry Harlow. So this guy was actually somewhat of a sadist. He used to do really crazy things to these poor monkeys. But he also was a very brilliant man. And he discovered essentially what, and I think he actually termed intrinsic motivation. So what he was doing was, the discovery happened, he was essentially testing the problem-solving abilities of these particular monkeys. So, and generally how an experiment would work, right? They give the monkey a puzzle, or let's say it's a mouse in a maze, and if it completes the maze, you reward it with food, right? So what he actually found, though, was that he was doing these experiments on these monkeys, and after the experiment ended, the monkeys would continue to play with the puzzle.
So this is actually his assumption, right?
Right. So this kind of went against everything in science, right? Because you think, okay, if we're going to reinforce this particular being with food, it should get better at that thing. But then he sort of realized that these monkeys were playing just for the sake of playing. Now, the fascinating thing is that when he continued the experiment and tried to reinforce the playful behavior, it actually had an extinguishing effect on behavior. I think, Jane, you have kids. I'm sure you know if you try to get your kids to play with something, they lose interest and they'll play with the box instead. And it's actually the same with a lot of animals as well. Like if you go to a dog or something like that, you take the toy out of its mouth, or you take something and try to force the dog to play with something, it loses interest and it's just like, I don't want to do this anymore. So Harry Harlow actually coined the term intrinsic motivation. So this is the animals or mammals' ability and want and need to seek and do new and novel things. Seek challenges just for the sake of doing it. So yeah, that's generally sort of the seeking system in a nutshell and the discovery that led to that phenomenon.
How are modern product designers using that to create actual products?
Okay, so if you look at a lot of products in a lot of successful products, they all satisfy the seeking system. So let's say one of the first big ones was the television set. Do you remember the old school TVs where they had a dial and you had to like get up off your chair and then like turn the dial to the next channel?
Oh, absolutely.
Right. So what happened was they invented the remote control, which sort of allows someone to kind of sit on their butt and just continue to like press next channel, next channel, next channel, right? So it's a constant feed of information, and the user, the human, really doesn't have to do much effortful operation to continue to seek. Seeking is about novelty. It's about finding new things. And what I say in the second part of the article, to create something that's like astoundingly addictive, once you bring reinforcement into the seeking system, then it becomes like crazy. So tools like Facebook, Instagram, etc. But this is something that's we have to understand here, is that you cannot reward seeking behaviors with extrinsic rewards. So what does work, though, with seeking behaviors is something called social affects. So an affect is something like a smile or frown. I'm sure, like, and humans are very adept at understanding this form of communication, right? If someone, like, screw faces you, you know, you're going to feel bad. But with products like Instagram and Facebook, I can operate, I can still consume this stream of information, right? Similar to a television, but obviously there's a more closer social connection to it. But I can also operate on the product, and I can express myself. So seeking is also about expressing yourself. And the reward that you get is actually a social affect that comes in the form of, let's say, a like, right? Or a little red dot that indicates that someone that you know, someone in your social circle, is liking something that you do. Now, there's probably a reason why there's not a hate button, because that would extinguish that particular behavior, right? So if you have a tool like Instagram, Facebook, or, you know, I consult with a lot of companies that are building social tools, the reinforcement through social affects is key in order to create something that is very engaging. And then again, you shouldn't start a company or build a product trying to get people addicted to it. At the end of the day, there's value behind it. And addiction is also a spectrum, right? So you could consider like a heroin addict on the very end of the spectrum, and then someone who dabbles in something at the very least. So at the end of the day, it's really just engagement, creating something that's engaging. And to do that, you really satisfy the seeking system, bring new novel information, and make it very easy to do that. Now, some people, the thing about an addictive product as well is that it's somewhat easy to use. So you could travel the world and you're still satisfying the seeking system, but it's a little bit more difficult than, again, sitting on your butt and hitting the next channel button on your remote control. So yeah, I hope that answered your question.
Oh, absolutely. So if we go beyond the classic newsfeed implementation that people are obviously willing to renew and pull down, like the Twitter feed with a little click, that little click sound, that sounds so great. So one pattern we can see here is the feed. Another could be, you know, a slideshow, which is an analogy of the TV channel, right? That we're swiping left to right.
Absolutely.
If we go beyond those social platforms, how can we bring patterns like that into more practical tools that we're building as software products that are not built for the sole entertainment purpose?
Yeah, so you can literally, by giving human or organism some options. So let's say you're pricing your services, etc. If you give different options, it gives the human or the animal more autonomy. So it gives them more power. So it makes them, it satisfies the seeking system in that way. Again, the seeking system is very autonomous, and it wants control, and it wants the ability to scan different options. Now, I think I mentioned later in the article that if you're, like, let's say an auto mechanic, you don't want to satisfy the seeking system. Maybe you just want to stick to that thing. Because at the end of the day, you could create something that's very engaging, but is it good for humanity? Maybe not.
Mm-hmm. So being addictive, is it always bad, or can it be a good thing?
Again, I don't think that addiction is it's a good word to describe the behavior, because, again, addiction is a spectrum. like anything in life, right? There's no like, if like what defines an addict, right? You could mm-hmm. when does the line cross? So really, it's just about creating something that's engaging and that someone wants to continue using. The beauty of these tools like Instagram, any sort of expressive tool, is that it gives the human the ability to express themselves, right? Which I think is naturally good. The problem happens when you do become addictive and then you keep checking these platforms somewhat not instinctively, but habitually, right? And then you're not doing the expressive work, and then you just constantly go back and back and back. And I think a lot of people fall into that loop. And that's what actually makes it somewhat difficult and challenging with in contemporary society, when we have all these tools that give us these social affects as rewards, and they become so engaging that we use them to almost to a non-functional level that actually hinders our performance.
As publishers, one example floats in the top of my mind is checking the stats on, you know, email marketing platforms, on my podcast publishing platform, where I use that number of downloads or views or clicks as a social confirmation that you're talking about.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it is, see, the thing about, I don't think you ever really know how something is going to be received if you're expressing yourself. But there is that constant, like, wanting to check to see how the public's receiving your work. And I think that's fine and natural.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned the word habit and I totally realize now that using the word addictive is, first, it's not informative, and second, it's just not great overall. But if we switch to, you know, habit-forming products, which sounds more human, definitely. I've read a book which is super famous. I don't know how to pronounce the author's name. Charles Duhigg, I think. The Power of Habit, which is a fantastic book. Do you think any of the takeaways could be used in designing digital products?
Absolutely. Absolutely. So the thing about habits and the thing about, again, addictive products that I think I forgot to mention previously was that when you do give the – and I think the Power of Habit talks very much about reinforcement, right? So just the classical standard definition of conditioning. So the organism operates on its environment. You touch an electric fence, it shocks you, so you don't touch the electric fence again. And that's like with anything. I think everything boils down, value is chemical, and it all happens in the brain. But in order to create something that is habit-forming, let's say it's even addictive, and what I forgot to mention is that the behavior will actually increase if there's variance in the reward. Mm-hmm. So this is something that makes Facebook and heroin so addictive. Let's say if you get a bag of see the thing about, and I'm using drugs and products as like synonymously. So the thing about heroin is that, let's say if I go to my dealer or go to a specific dealer and he has a specific grade of heroin, each time that bag of heroin is going to be different, right? So I'm going to get a different high. So I'm always going to be chasing a specific high, probably the best high that I got. Now, Facebook is very similar, Instagram, whatever social tool it may be, because you operate on your environment. So I express myself by posting whatever, a selfie picture, I don't know, some expressive element, and the public will give you their feedback, but it's always variant, meaning it's not like I put something out there and it's the same reward every single time. It's different, and that makes it even more engaging, because the humans always want to chase that high, and all organisms do.
In your experience, you mentioned that you frequently get requests from your clients to do something with social components and stuff like that. Do you have any interesting stories how you managed to solve that request, implement that, and actually build something that got the users really using it?
Let me think. Well, first of all, if you want to create, okay, let's for example, I worked with a company that was creating a sort of an Airbnb style application. Now, the thing about the Airbnb is that it largely satisfies the seeking system in that I can go on Airbnb and not even purchase a home. Or sorry, not purchase a home, but not even rent out a space. It's a lot of it is just about the exploratory aspect of it and imagining what I could rent. So if you're creating a tool like this, we have to understand as product designers, the user experience happens before and largely after the actual use of the product. So if I'm using a tool like Airbnb, I want to be able to move the map around, explore, and potentially see what I could use and imagine that. So if you can create these sort of imaginary experiences, then you're satisfying the seeking system and you're going to create something that's naturally engaging. We have to realize that the thought and the imagination of the value is sometimes even more powerful than the actual experience itself.
Is there anything we can do particularly in the interface to promote that feeling?
Yes. So number one is, and I think that we've seen I've worked in a lot of e-commerce projects, and one thing you want to do is make it very easy to scroll through this information. So let's take a product like Tinder or something like that, right? Number one is make your images large. Like so much of product design, UX, UI design is really just copy and images. So really make the image sing. Oftentimes you'll see e-commerce stores, and I think, you know, even like eBay and Amazon, I think make the mistake of putting these little thumbnails on the page. What you really want to do is boost up the image and make it very engaging. Now, if you're creating like a media-specific tool, maybe a dark background will work better because it'll make the image pop. Now, if your product is more text-heavy, then a white background will probably work because that's going to make it easier to see the information.
Mm-hmm. So our goals here, just to recap, are to reduce the friction in consumption of that so that the user can fully give away to the imagination instead of thinking about technical details and trying to encourage that immersing experience.
Absolutely. So reduce the amount of information that the user has to articulate in the brain. So again, like going back to the TV remote case, next channel, next channel, next channel, right? They're really only hitting that one button, at least in old school TV. Now, you know, obviously tools like Netflix is a very prime example of satisfying the seeking system. I don't know how many times I've been on Netflix and just browsed for about like 2 hours and never watched anything, right? So humans inherently like judging the things that they might want to watch. And again, images are very, very engaging to people and humans. That's why, you know, that's probably one of the reasons why Netflix is so successful is it is because of the browsing experience. It's not necessarily the content, but the way that they organize the information in different sections, you know, maybe give you recommendations. It creates a very immersive browsing experience.
Since we're talking about social aspects and social rewards, I think commenting systems and rating systems, they're not specifically about rewards, but they help us a lot in consuming content and comparing it with other content. What is your take on that? Does including a comment system or a rating system improve the product, or maybe sometimes it hurts?
Yeah, that's actually a really great question. I don't know if I have the answer to that, but if anything, I would say it improves it. Because again, you have that expressive element. And I think that's one of the reasons why YouTube is so successful. And it also provides a different level of validation to a specific piece of content. For example, it's if I see a YouTube video and it has 90% dislikes, I know that that's probably not a credible piece of information. And also, you can scroll down after the video and see the plethora of like theological rants that go on, which I think is naturally engaging, and it's a good thing. Again, I think the goal should always to be create good stuff, create good things with value, and then because if you're creating unvaluable things, it's going to get a low rating. That might hurt your business, but that's just good feedback.
Turning on and turning off comments is probably a separate topic for discussion. And YouTube by itself is also a separate topic for discussion. First, they do have that dislike button that you mentioned before. There is no dislike button on Twitter, for example, but there is one on YouTube. And also, yeah. If you explore their mobile UI, for example, their iPhone app, you can see that comments are buried so deep underneath all the information about the video, then like 20 different recommendations, and only then can you see the comments. I'm sure there must be some politics behind that decision.
I'm sure there is.
Do you think that's because comments sometimes can be a sort of a waste field if the audience is too unqualified, or is there any other reason?
Definitely. And I think that's also why tools like Reddit are so powerful, right? Mm-hmm. Because the audience can decide, and generally, if you're getting a lot of upvotes and your content is, or let's say the most valuable comment is at the top, I think that's really better for everyone, right? Because the audience will decide. Like, remember, like, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire? The audience is always right. The more sample you get, so the more people are viewing your stuff and they're upvoting it, the most valuable stuff will be at the top.
Thank you for bringing up Reddit, because it brings us to the whole ecosystem of products like that, which is Product Hunt, for example, Hacker News, Reddit, once again, Designer News, systems which combine the news feed with the rating system. Do you have any interesting case studies or stories with products other than social media that you would like to share with our audience that implement those principles of satisfying the seeking system? Maybe physical products for the change.
Physical products, not so much. Physical products, I think, tend to be a little bit more utilitarian in nature. So they have a very specific function, let's say a chef's knife. But even if you take something like a chef's knife, right, you're cutting, you're manipulating on your environment, and it's generally a tool for expression. So you're providing food, let's say, for your loved ones. Another case study would be one of the first products I worked on was a image recognition software application. So the discovery came from, like, have you ever seen, like, you know, if you pick up a magazine off a shelf, what you'll notice is, and you can see it probably anywhere, is that human being will go from back to front and just flip through pages, right? Mm-hmm. So they'll put the thumb on the edge and then just continue to look at stuff. You know, it doesn't even really matter if they're buying it or not. People generally like doing that, and they like looking at new, novel things all the time. So if you can do that, or give your users options and give them autonomy, you're inherently satisfying the seeking system.
Well, thank you, Jeff. I think I satisfied my curiosity a ton on the topic. Thank you for providing such thoughtful answers. Where can people find you and your work online?
Yeah, so you can just go to my site, jeffdavidsondesign.com. I'm on all social media. You're going to find the most value if you go to my Medium account and read my articles there. I try to stay away from, I try to stay away from some of the social media platforms because, again, it's kind of hypocritical if I just check them all day. But yeah, the best bet is just go to jeffdavidsondesign.com and then contact me through there.
Amazing. Well, thank you for your time once again, Jeff, and I hope you have a great day.
Not a problem. Thank you so much, Jane.
If you enjoyed listening to this episode, please leave a review on iTunes. It will help other people discover this podcast.